been asked to talk a little bit this morning on the topic of what is love. And this is something that... has come up a few times in the last few days in my discussions with people, and one of the interesting things about it, of course, is that we have such a mixture of ideas that come under the English word love. And of course you have like family love and spiritual love, or you have erotic love and sexual love and all different kinds of things that come under the word love. And those things can be quite different. So sometimes when people come to Buddhism, it's almost like a feeling that they've been told that they have to let go of their attachments. Yeah? Is that right? So then you feel like, oh, well, you can't love your family anymore because I'm not allowed to have any attachments. That's what my mum thought anyway. Yeah? Because she was brought up as a Christian, so she didn't understand about Buddhism. So, you know, she's, what's this thing about attachments? She just found out this thing that she was supposed to let go of attachments. So she's very worried about this, yeah? Yeah? Does that mean that you're not allowed to love anymore because you don't have any attachments? It's a bit kind of scary, isn't it? Yeah? But of course that's not what the Buddha meant when he was talking about love and attachments and so on. And we know that because that's exactly what it says in the Metta Sutra, isn't it? In the Metta Sutra it says, Mata yata niyang buddhang ayusa eka buddhmanu rakhe evampi sabbalokasming mana sambhavaye aparimanang. Just as a mother would love her only son, in the same way, would give her life for her only child. In the same way that one should love the whole world. Yeah? So it's not saying that you shouldn't love your family. Yeah? What it's saying is you shouldn't stop your love at your family. It's saying you shouldn't limit your love for your family. Yeah? The metta that the Buddha talked about is always apamana. Yeah? Measureless. Limitless. Yeah? And that's the challenge of the spiritual love, is not that you have to give up loving your family, but you have to ask yourself, why do I love only my family? Why do I restrict my love just to my husband or my wife or just to my children or just to my parents? Why is it that it's only this group of people that I love and not that group of people? Yeah? And so when we look at the world today, we see so much of the problems in the world is caused because of people who, this tendency that we always have, we have this kind of tribal tendency. We love people who are like us. Yeah? Same, if someone has the same skin color, or the same nationality, or the same religion, or the same language, or the same culture, or whatever, then we feel a connection with them. Right? And if somebody's different, and it's like, ooh, it's a bit scary. They're wearing funny clothes. Yeah? I bet people think that about me all the time, yeah? When I'm walking around in Sydney and so on, people probably look at me and think, oh, he's wearing funny clothes. I wonder what kind of weird person that is. Yeah? Sometimes I find myself thinking that. I'm walking through Sydney and I think, oh, they're wearing funny clothes. You can be very recognizable. One time I was walking through the streets of Sydney. I was on my way back from a dentist's appointment. And I was just walking along the side of the road. And this man's driving his car, and his car screeches to a stop, and he runs over to see me. And he says to me, are you the Today FM celebrity fugitive? The Today FM celebrity fugitive. What's the Today FM celebrity fugitive? Sorry, I've got no idea what you're talking about. So apparently there's a radio station in Sydney and they have a competition, and the competition is what they call the celebrity fugitive, and they get a celebrity and they dress up in some kind of costume And they wander around the streets of Sydney until somebody recognizes them. So if you go up to them and you say, are you the Today FM celebrity fugitive? Then you win some kind of prize. Right? Right? And that day, it was a football player dressed up as a Buddhist monk. Right? So here's me, you know, and I'm sort of quite tall and stuff, and, you know, this kind of tall Western guy wandering around Sydney dressed as a Buddhist monk, of course, is your jackpot, you know. I'm surprised more people didn't come up and ask me. So I had to disappoint him, say, no, sorry, I'm not the Today FM celebrity fugitive. All right. But anyway, he said, where are you going? I told him. He said, oh, well, I'll give you a lift. So he gave me a lift, and then he started asking me about meditation and stuff, so it was good anyway. All worked out. So this is, I think, one of the big problems that we have in our world, is that we're still emotionally, we're conditioned and we're trained to have that love in a very limited way, yeah? For a person that we're close to, a family that we're close to. And we find it difficult to feel that love for those outside of us. Now, there's a name for that kind of love that we use in Western terminology, and we call that narcissism. And the word narcissism is based on a Greek myth, and it's a story of a young man called Narcissus, who was very beautiful, very good-looking young man, and one day he happened to catch a glimpse of himself in a pond of water, his reflection in the still water, and he immediately fell in love. Yeah? Who is that beautiful creature that I spy there in the water? Oh, they look so fair, so lovely. And he ended up just gazing. He spent the rest of his life just gazing at his own reflection in the mirror. Does anybody here do that? Waste their life gazing at their own reflection in the mirror? Yeah? So that's narcissism. So it's interesting. You see what is actually going on there. And yeah? as with a lot of these myths and stories, is that they capture something very true about them. You know, what's going on there is that he's falling in love with an image, right? This kind of image, this external projection of himself. There's no kind of reality. He's lost touch with who he really is. Yeah, and has fallen just in love with an image. And that's often what happens in our emotional life when we fall in love with somebody, yeah? Because often the initial stage of falling in love with someone is based on very external things. It's based on what does someone look like, yeah? Yeah? It's based on, you know, the surface things of their personality, or, you know, are they funny, or, you know, witty or charming or something like that. And we fall in love with all of these kind of external things. And the sad thing about that is that the more we get distracted by those externals, the more we miss out, the more we see what happens underneath, what's happening behind them. And in that story of Narcissus, actually there wasn't anything happening behind it. He fell completely in love with his own face, with that own image, and there's nothing behind it, yeah? It's only an image. It's only, not even skin deep, just like the surface of the water is that image. So this is that kind of very limited form of love that you have, which is within every person, okay? Every person has at least some of that. But as we grow older and as we develop, we learn to extend that. We learn to, our love and our appreciation of other people grows and matures. We learn to recognize people more and more for who they are, what's actually inside them. And we make a connection with people on a deeper level. And so this is one of the messages, I think, of every great spiritual teacher. And if we look at all of the great spiritual teachers, they're always somewhere in their message is this calling people out to a deeper, to a broader sense of what love is. On today, because today obviously is Christmas. Oh, and Merry Christmas, everyone. Are you all having Christmas parties and stuff after this? I know some of you are on retreat, so you're not, but is it, what about other people? Is that a thing? No? No? A few people nodding? Do Buddhists have a boring Christmas in Singapore? No, of course not. You've come to the Buddhist Fellowship. That's your Christmas party. Okay, very good. So, and on Christmas, I think it's appropriate to point out a few, or maybe to mention a few things of similarity between Buddhism and Christianity. And, you know, as one of the central messages also of Jesus' life was that message of love, yeah, message of love your neighbour, love your enemies. And that was kind of one of the great things that he tried to do in the environment that Jesus found himself in Israel 2,000 years ago, was that people were very divided. Yeah, the Jewish people were divided against the Romans, and even within the Jewish community themselves, people were divided against each other. So you have all these different groups, the Pharisees and the Samaritans and all of these groups, and I don't even know really what they are. They're just words that you read in the Bible. And when I was at school, brought up in a Catholic school, and you kind of read these stories and the Sadducees and the something something, and I never knew what they were. But anyway, they're different groups within the Jewish community at the time, and there often was a lot of conflict between them, as there is between all groups, yeah? All groups of people tend to have that conflict. And so this is one of the things that Jesus tried to bring, was this message that actually the higher calling and the spiritual calling that we had was to love each other, everyone, no matter who we were. And of course, it's very similar to the message that the Buddha gave. And, you know, today on Christmas Day, the day of the birth of Jesus, and I don't know if you've ever noticed, but there's a lot of similarities in the birth of Jesus and the birth of the Buddha. Have you ever noticed that? Yeah? A similarity, one of them is that they were both born on a journey. Yeah? So Jesus was born in the manger and so on, but they were at an inn. The Buddha was born, or Siddhartha was born in the park in Lumbini on a journey. Actually, that being born on a journey is a very common kind of motif. You find this in a lot of stories. And actually, is at least in the Indian context, is quite realistic, because actually the mothers would often return back to the maternal home. The Buddha's parents were living in Kapilavastu, in the father's home, and they returned to the city of the mother's home to give birth. And that's kind of custom, and still up until recently has been the custom in much of India and Sri Lanka. I'm not quite sure why the custom is there. It sounds like a very uncomfortable custom for the poor old mum. There's plenty of stories of the mum giving birth halfway back on the journey, which can't have been very convenient for anybody concerned. So I'm not quite sure why that custom arose. But the meaning of that, I think, is also quite significant, because the meaning of it is that you don't, it's like spiritual meaning of that as a metaphor, as a symbol, is that you don't belong to one or the other. Yeah? So you're born on the in-between. Yeah? You're born in between the mother and the father's home. You don't actually belong to either of them. And by not belonging to one or the other, in a sense, you belong to all. Yeah? And I think that's the meaning of what that birth on a journey is all about, that there's a sense that this is the arrival of some kind of figure or some teacher who's going to be of universal significance. He's not bound down to one particular family or one particular place, but is of universal significance. So some of the other similarities, one of the similarities was in when the Buddha was born, there was supposed to be a great light appeared in the sky. Yeah? And so the same when Jesus is born, you have the star of Bethlehem appears in the sky. Some people say it was like a supernova or something like that appeared, and the astronomers saw, I don't know. And then there's the wise men, yeah, so when the Buddha was born, or Siddhartha was born, then they're kind of the Brahmins come to prophesy and sort of say that this great teacher's arrived. And when Jesus was born, you had the three wise men come out of the east. I don't know what the three wise men are doing coming out of the east. Were they Buddhist monks? I don't know. Maybe. Wandering monks got lost a bit. Anyway, so they came to see Jesus. So that's already quite a few parallels, isn't it? Yeah. So that doesn't necessarily mean that there was any direct influence of one story on the other, because you often find that in ancient myths that they're actually all the way that the stories are told they draw upon these kind of ideas and storytelling motifs, which become a way of presenting the birth, so that they can be, they're all kind of drawing from this stock set of images. So when we look at the Buddha's life, one of the in Christianity, of course, the main celebrations is Christmas and Easter, isn't it? The birth and the death of Jesus. And so in Buddhism we have a number of other dates. We celebrate the birth and the death of the Buddha. Well, I don't know if we celebrate the death of the Buddha. Anyway, we remember the death of the Buddha. But also the enlightenment. Yeah? And so the enlightenment probably is even more important, I think. Actually, from a Buddhist point of view, everyone is born and everyone dies. Right? So the birth of the Buddha, in a sense, is nothing special. Even the death of the Buddha, in a sense, is nothing special. Everyone has to be born and everyone has to die. But what is really special is the enlightenment, the awakening that happened at Bodh Gaya. And this is what we really remember. This is the really special thing. Now, one of the great dilemmas that you have when you look at the Buddha's story, the Buddha got enlightened all by himself. He was a renunciate. He was an ascetic. He'd left his family behind. Yeah? So wasn't that very cruel of him? Went off in the middle of the night, left the poor missus behind. What would you think if your husband walked out on you in the middle of the night? Oh, it's all right if it's the Buddha, because then it's a story, yeah? But what if it happened, really? Yeah? It'd be kind of scary, isn't it? Yeah? Does that mean that the Buddha didn't love his family? His wife? His newborn son? What about his parents? In the earliest story of the Buddha's going forth, it says, the word it uses in Pali, Mata Pitunang Rodantanang, even though my mother and father wept with tears running down their face, still, I left. Yeah? So this is very challenging. Yeah? It's very challenging for our idea of what is love, what is the meaning of love. How can we say that somebody who left their family behind, created so much sorrow in his wake, could still be somebody who was full of love? So I think this is a point in the Buddha's story that we have to think of very carefully and we have to reflect on. I don't think we should try to explain it away. Like some people, sometimes I've heard people try to explain it and say, it was okay because we know that the Buddhas had an extended family and that the child would have been looked after and the wife would have been looked after and so on and so forth, therefore it's all right. Well, yeah, maybe there's some truth to that, but still would have hurt, right? Yeah? And I think we're kind of missing the point if we try to explain it away. The very issue, the crux of the matter is that he left. And one of the things that I found to be very interesting is when we look in the Buddhist Jataka stories, and the stories, 550 stories of the Buddha's life before this life, and in many of those stories, he also goes forth, and each time he goes forth, it's a little bit different, something happens, there's never quite the same in two tellings. So sometimes his wife wants to go forth as well. Sometimes they go forth together, right? They make two little huts in the forest and they live there. Some places, the whole kingdom decides to go forth, right? So the whole city and all the kingdom decide to go forth as monks. So they all leave the kingdom. There's nothing left behind. And they all go off into the forest and set up a huge monastery in the forest, which again becomes like a little city. And I don't know if you know, but there's one story in all of the 550 Jataka stories, there's one little story tucked away which not many people know about, and that's the story of what happened when the Bodhisattva's wife left him behind. Did you know that? Yeah, so there's one story. It's not just the bloke who wanders off and leaves the missus behind, right? But the missus wanders off, and leaves the husband behind to look after the kids. Yeah? So that should give some hope to all of the women here. It's true in one of the stories, because, you know, of course, in all the Jataka stories, the Buddha and is supposed to, or the Bodhisattva is supposed to have been married to Yashodhara, his wife in this life. So one time they were married, they had three children, and they were sitting one time around the dinner table, and the Bodhisattva says, you know, really, darling, I'd really like to go forth and become a monk. And the missus says to him, well, actually, that's kind of funny, because really I'd like to go forth and become a nun. It's amazing, actually, you know, when you see that. I mean, it's interesting for me to see as a monk and to see people's families and the kind of the lives that they live and these kinds of things. And a few weeks ago I gave a meditation workshop in a yoga center in north of Sydney. And when I went up there just to teach, and in this yoga center, it was such an idyllic environment. It was just a beautiful place, and the community, it was a lovely community of people, and everyone was very kind of warm and friendly, and it was quite close to the beach. It was very kind of happy and friendly. It was like a holiday kind of environment. And I was talking to the guy who was running the center, you know, and he was a kind of a young guy, I guess maybe 30 or something like that. And he's obviously very happily married. He had a beautiful wife. They had a lovely child, and they were playing around. And it was like this perfect, happy, idyllic environment where they could all do exactly what they wanted to do. And I was talking to him for a little while, and he said to me, he said, you know, Bhante, I'm really just waiting for my son to grow up so I can become a monk. So everything looks so beautiful, so wonderful. Anyway, so the Bodhisattva and his wife, and they were like, well, I guess we have to wait for the children to grow up. And the wife says, okay, I guess we have to wait for the children to grow up, and then we can go forth and become monks or nuns. Well, that's settled then. So then the missus says, oh, excuse me, darling, I have to pop outside and get a pail of water from the well. So she pops outside and then runs away. They're all sitting around waiting for the water to come back. She's taking a while, so she goes off and becomes a nun. And he's left behind looking after the kids. So that's what he does. He looks after the kids until they're old enough to look after themselves. And then he goes forth and becomes a monk. Later on, he meets his former wife again, when he's a monk now and she's a nun. And he says to her, what? You ran away and left us. And she's like, well, you were supposed to look after the kids. So I think that's a very kind of interesting story, you know, to show because how the tables get turned, yeah? But it's a genuine problem. And I don't want to sort of try to trivialize it. I don't want to try to pretend that it doesn't exist. It's a real problem. It really exists. And it really matters for many people who are practicing. Sometimes it matters, yes, if you want to go forth, but it also matters even for people not necessarily who are going forth, but even people on a more mundane level. You know, maybe some of you have faced that choice in coming here today. I don't know, there's probably some people here whose parents or grandparents or something wanted them to stay behind for a family event today, but then you said, no, I want to go to the Buddhist center and listen to some Dhamma. Yeah. And so you find these kinds of tensions constantly that are being played out in the community and in people's lives. And what's going on when we look at that is it's not really about cruelty in leaving a family behind or anything like that. But what it's about is a shift in our understanding and an expression of the love that we have from a love which is restricted and bound and caught up with this person or with this small group of people, and a way of expressing love and a way of having that loving kindness which is open and broad and which encompasses all beings. Yeah? Now, it's not that those two kinds of love are mutually exclusive. It's not that that it's impossible to live in the family and to have that kind of broader love. It's just that the tendency is to want to kind of limit it, and it's a struggle to try to broaden that. And so what is the essential difference there? What's the essential difference between the love which is based on, if you like, attachment or grasping or craving, and the love which is based on the spiritual love? And what I think, you know, really the essential difference is that the love which is based on craving is always the love that wants to get something. Whereas the spiritual love is the love which doesn't want to get anything. It just wants to give. Normally, when we love someone, very often, if you look closely at that feeling, actually it's usually a mixture of things. But part of that feeling that you have when you love someone is the feeling, I love you because you make me feel good. You make me happy, and that's why I love you. Yeah? Isn't that true? Yeah, a lot of the time. And when that person stops making us happy, yeah, then, oh well, no point in loving them anymore. Yeah? So that's how you know it's a kind of selfish love. Yeah? And that's why that real love and that real kind of deep love, that the genuine love that people can have for each other, is something which is much more long-lasting, and something which, as it says in the marriage vows, you know, in sickness and in health, yeah? So even when the bad times, even when it's not actually going to, you know, when I'm not getting anything, that I still give. You kind of, one of the classic examples of that expression was in the Vinaya, where, and I'm sure many of you know the story of the monk who was sick. And one time there was a monk who was sick and was lying in his sick bed, and the Buddha saw him and he said, why don't the monks look after this monk? And the monk said to him, because he doesn't do any good for us. He doesn't help us. We don't get anything out of it. So why should we? This monk saying that. It's terrible, isn't it? And so the Buddha then, led by example, he went to pick the monk up, cleaned him, moved him, cleaned his bedding, and looked after him. And he said that anybody who would look after him, that is, anybody who would look after the Buddha, would look after the sick. Yeah? So I think this is also another very beautiful example, that practical, that love is not just something which is a nice feeling, but love is something which is very practical. And that if our love is only abstract, it's only an idea, and it doesn't actually manifest in practice, in what we do, then there's something wrong there. There's something imbalanced. So when we're practicing, when we're doing our metta and our loving kindness, we need to be doing both of those things. Both the love in terms of the internal development of metta, but also in terms of the external, of actually helping people, actually doing things. You might know the parable of the Good Samaritan. Since again, it's Christmas, and I'm giving a few Christian parallels here. Do you know the parable of the Good Samaritan? It's a little bit like that story of the Buddha helping the sick monk, actually. But in that parable, I'm just thinking if I can get it straight in my head. But there was a certain man who fell in with thieves, and he got mugged and beaten up and lay by the side of the road bleeding. And different people went past, and I can't remember who was it went past. I think a Pharisee and a priest or something like that went past, and they just kind of ignored him, crossed over the road and went on. And then finally the Samaritan saw him, and my understanding was that in those days in Israel, that the Samaritans were regarded as the kind of the lowest people, so they were kind of the least high class ones, but he was the one who crossed over and who helped him. So that's a little bit like the story of the Buddha helping the sick monk. But what's one of the things that's interesting about that story of the Good Samaritan is that there was recently a psychological study done of that. And what they did is they got these various Christian priests to teach this parable. And the psychological study was to see whether teaching this parable actually made people act in a more compassionate manner. Okay? But it was one of these trick studies, because the priests who were teaching it thought that the audience was going to be tested. In fact, it was them who was being tested. And what they did is that they arranged to have a beggar or a sick person or a person in need on the road outside in front of the hall where they were going to be teaching. Yeah? And so they wanted to see, if you're on your way to teach about the Good Samaritan, would you actually stop to help the man who was in need outside the hall? Yeah? And they found that they didn't. Yeah? That they would walk past. They're so preoccupied. Oh, I've got to give this sermon. I've got to give my kind of notice. And the Good Samaritan, he goes, oh, shut up, leave me alone. And I've got to get this. It's true. Yeah? So that's not something about, doesn't tell you anything about Christianity. That tells you something about humanity, yeah? That we can get caught up in our ideas about loving kindness and compassion, yeah? We can get up in our ideas about Buddhist ideas about merit and so on. And somebody once told this joke about the Buddhist version of the Good Samaritan is somebody's would be walking past with some food or something like that, and they'd see the Good Samaritan and they think, oh, should I give them some food? They saw the injured person by the side of the road who's starving and in need of food, and then they think, should I give them some food? And then they're like, no, I'll make more merit if I give it to the monks, so I'll go and give it to the monks instead. Yeah. So there's also some truth to that, isn't it? So it's not about one religion or another religion, but it's about saying that in our life, our spiritual life, we can sometimes embrace these ideas of compassion and love and so on, because they're easy words to say. They're easy ideals to have. No one's going to argue with you if you talk about these things. Yeah? And so as a monk, and since I've been a Buddhist teacher for a long time now, for many years, and one of the things that I've done, again following my own teacher Ajahn Brahm, is I've talked about some controversial things, and I haven't been shy to mention when there's been problems and difficulties and so on, as many of you know with the bhikkhuni ordinations and other things. And I see the problem with the bhikkhuni ordination and the lack of acceptance of bhikkhunis. It's basically this problem. It's the problem that we've got so used to talking about love and compassion and so on that we forget that actually we've excluded a lot of people from that. I don't know if you've noted, but you know, in the Pali we have a chant of metta, and it's most famously known by the very beautiful recording that was made about 10 years or so by, what's her name, Imi Su or someone? In Malaysia, and it's a very beautiful chant, and it goes, you know, through all the different people that you have doing metta for. And if you look closely at the words of that, it says you have metta for all the bhikkhus, have metta for all the samaneras, have metta for all the laymen, you have metta for all the lay women. But there's no metta for bhikkhunis. Did you notice that? In that chant, that's the official Theravadan chant of developing metta is for all beings except for bhikkhunis. It's a bit of a worry, isn't it? Yeah? And you see, that's the actual reality. Yeah. So when the issue of ordaining bhikkhunis and so on comes up, then rather than responding with compassion, responding with understanding, actually what's going on is that there are these people who are human beings who wish to practice the Dhamma Vinaya of the Lord Buddha in order to realize the escape from suffering. Yeah? That's what's actually happening. And so rather than responding with compassion and with love for that and to help them, regardless of minor details like gender, then there becomes this big obstacle and this big opposition to helping. And so this is that kind of lack of compassion and loving kindness. So I think it's important, and the reason why I mention this is because it's important for us to recognize that these things that do happen. They happen even among monks who've been practicing for many years. It happens among you. It happens in the people here in the Buddhist Fellowship. It happens to people in other Buddhist groups and other religions. It's a normal part of being human. It's not a sign that necessarily anything is wrong. It's just a sign that, well, we're not there yet. Yeah, we still have work to do. And so we need to keep on working, keep on reminding ourselves when these things happen, when we see on the news, you know, the riots and protests happening in various kinds of the world, and the violence that happens, and we see people acting with that such violence, we remind ourselves, actually, the seeds of that are still present within me. As long as I'm not enlightened, I still have the seeds of that present within me. I can't blame and criticize these people for doing those things, because one day I could be there. If I was in different circumstances, maybe I would be the one holding the gun or holding the stick and hitting that person. I don't know. And until you've been in that situation, we can't know what we would do. Yeah? So this is, again, that extending of compassion and extending of loving kindness. So this is something which is not, which sounds like it's very simple, sounds like it's very easy, but actually is a continual challenge. Yeah? It's a continual challenge to see where we can bring that, how far we can extend that. What kinds of things are really going to challenge you? I remember when I was talking to one of my Sri Lankan friends in Australia a few years ago. He said, you know, when I'm doing metta meditation, I can have metta for everyone except for John Howard. I just can't. So he's like, okay, just keep on trying, all right? Keep on trying. Yeah. So somewhere we got that thing, and that thing we get stuck, and that's where we learn. Yeah, you learn by those places where you get stuck. So don't be afraid of them. Yeah, if you find there's that person that you just get really annoyed with, that's your great bodhisattva. That's your great teacher. Yeah. You feel gratitude to them. Oh, what do they have to teach me? Yeah. Okay, so it's 12 o'clock. I think we should be having some Q&A now. Is that right? I think we should be doing some Q&A. All right, so please, some questions.
Anybody have any questions? Raise your hands. I'll bring the mic to you so everybody can hear your question loud and clear. No questions? Christmas time, questions are free. Answers are also free. This will be a present for today.
Hello, good morning, Ajahn. When we send metta, who do we send to, or do they really receive it or not? Maybe a lot of people have some doubts, you know, whether, you know, is it a change within yourself or change outside the environment?
So when you send metta, do they actually get it? Well, I think what you should do is ask them. Why not? Yeah? Don't tell them. Just you do some meditation. Let's say you're meditating at 7:30 or something like that, and then you send metta to your mum, and then you just give your mum a call a day or two later and say, oh, last night, what were you doing around 7:30? And they say, oh, you know, I was having a cup of tea or watching telly or something. And then you say, oh, did you feel anything unusual? Or? Yeah, and you never know, yeah, whether they feel it or not. Yeah. Actually, my personal belief, I think that everything is connected, and I think that we have an energy in us, and we have a consciousness, and that consciousness resonates, and I think that we're constantly affecting all people around us. I think everyone in this room is affecting all the other people in this room, and I think that this is going on the whole time, all the time across the whole world. And so when we spread metta, we're developing, normally we affect people, but because our minds are scattered and not focused and so on, then it tends to be dissipated. You know, it's more like kind of white noise. Yeah? But when we do meditation, it's focused and it's more concentrated and more powerful. So I think that the effect that we have is going to be stronger. So I do think there's that effect, and I do think sometimes people are aware of it. I think sometimes they're probably not aware. That depends on, you know, if you can be broadcasting a radio signal, but somebody has to tune in the receiver as well, yeah? So if somebody's not paying attention at the other end, they probably won't notice. But I think it still has an effect.
I'd like to ask an advice. Is it advisable to do metta when you're really down and depressed? Because I find that it's really hard to get that happiness feeling out.
Yeah, that's a good question. And as a general rule, probably best not to do metta when you're feeling very depressed. You can try it. It's not going to hurt. But what can happen is that you just end up feeling worse because you're like, you know, you're feeling depressed, and then you try to feel, oh, well, I can't feel happy, so I'm going to feel even more depressed now. Yeah, so you can go in this kind of negative spiral. So actually, for someone who's depressed, if it's just a passing mood, okay, I would say just be aware of it. Yeah, practice mindfulness. Be aware of that feeling. Don't get too into the feeling. Don't focus on it too much because you can kind of get drawn into it. Yeah. So just practice a kind of a gentle kind of mindfulness. Oh, okay, there's that sad feeling. Yeah. And okay, just focus on that and then come back and then just go into just mindfulness of the body. So just be aware of your postures and position of your body or something like that until that passes. Yeah. If the depression is more kind of chronic, if you really sort of have a long term depression, then doing some mindfulness-based practice is very useful, but it should be done carefully, and it should be done under proper supervision, you know, to make sure that it's going to go in the right way. Because when our emotions are, let's say, unbalanced, yeah, then we need to be very careful when we're developing meditation, because you can end up just enhancing, or the negative emotions can just get greater than they were before. So you need to be a bit careful with that one. So best to just practice with mindfulness until the feeling of sadness or depression doesn't necessarily completely go away, but until it lessens and eases up, and then do some metta. That's what I would suggest.
Okay, we have another question here.
Morning, Anjan.
Good morning.
You mentioned earlier on about Narcissus who fell in love with his own image.
Yeah.
I've been reading a lot about Ajahn Chah lately, and he mentioned about the senses and how basically it's not about shutting out the senses. It's not about and not letting them into your brain, because otherwise, for instance, a blind person would be enlightened. How does that work, and what is your personal advice? It obviously means that you're not ignoring whatever comes into your mind through your senses, but how do you deal with it? Do you have any personal advice on that?
Yeah, well, that advice comes also straight out of the suttas. Yeah, there's suttas where the Buddha, in fact, uses exactly that argument in the Indriya Bhavana Sutta, Majjhima 152, and other places. So yes, this is something that's important, that the senses are our friends. Okay, so the senses is how we learn. We learn by seeing, we learn by hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, and we learn through the mind. So we shouldn't see senses as being something which is an enemy or something which is a problem. But the problem is that we tend to misconstrue it. We get attached to our senses, and we take them to be something which is more than what they are. So that instead of our senses acting to serve and help us, yeah, we become the slave of our senses. So our life becomes devoted to finding beautiful things to see, beautiful things to hear, beautiful things to smell, taste, touch, and so on. Yeah, so that's fairly obvious. That's what most people's life is, isn't it? Yeah. And that's what media and advertising and so on is selling to you all the time. Yeah. So, I think that's really the key, is that rather than us serving the senses, that the senses should be serving us. When I say us, what I mean is to be serving wisdom, or to be serving the mind, serving awareness. Yeah. So we do that through contemplating. And when you see something, you recognize, oh, it's impermanent. Yeah, when you hear something, you know, oh, it's impermanent. Yeah, it doesn't have to be a big deal, you know. And you know, even like Christmas time. Yeah. Well, Christmas time you get presents, right? Even I'm a monk. Even I've got a couple of presents. And, you know, what's the difference? Yeah, well, the difference is that when you're practicing, when you open up your Christmas present, you say, oh, well, this is impermanent. Yeah? Doesn't mean you can't enjoy the present, but you know, oh, actually, it's impermanent. It's not going to last forever. It's not going to bring me permanent happiness. It's an expression of someone's kindness and care that they want to give this. That's great. So you still respect that and rejoice in that kindness that they have, but you recognize it's impermanent. And when you know it's impermanent, you don't get so excited by it. And when it breaks or it wears out or gets used up, you don't get so disappointed.
Any more questions? Last question, calling ones. Oh, yes.
Ajahn, could you explain again about the difference between metta and compassion?
The difference between metta and compassion, why do you want to know?
How is it related, or does that mean compassion, when you have compassion, does that mean you already have metta? But maybe you are not aware that you have this kind of metta, because normally... Mm-hmm. Compassion is towards others being, right, when they are uh-huh. suffering, uh-huh. right? Is that equal to have metta?
Okay. The basic difference between them, if you want to look for a difference, the basic difference is that metta is much more simple. And metta doesn't know anything about suffering. Okay, so you know that the basic simile the Buddha said, just like the love of a mother for her only child. So metta is just that very, very simple, pure wish for the happiness of oneself or happiness of others. Whereas compassion begins with an understanding of suffering. All right, compassion begins with recognizing the suffering in oneself or the suffering in others. So say that example of the Good Samaritan, yeah? So this is compassion, is recognizing the suffering of somebody and then wanting to do something about it, wanting to relieve that suffering. And that's the essence of compassion. As metta hasn't even learned about suffering yet. Doesn't even know what suffering is. Metta is just a pure wish for happiness. It's very simple and very childlike, yeah? So this way, metta is less mature, it's less profound, it's less wisdom to it, yeah? Because compassion has more wisdom, it's a more mature emotion, yeah? Compassion is a deeper emotion, which is one of the reasons why, when we're starting meditation, why I emphasize a lot on teaching metta rather than compassion. Because if we start with doing metta, basically you're never going to have any problems with doing that, okay? Metta is almost completely free of side effects, okay? It's not going to have any problem. Whereas compassion, you can sometimes have problems with. Not with real compassion, of course, but with people who don't have enough wisdom. And so sometimes what can happen, and they call it in volunteer circles, they call it compassion fatigue, yeah? It's not real compassion, but it's what, when you're not mature enough, is that you over-identify with the suffering of others. You can get drawn up and caught into that, and then that can lead you down into despair and to hopelessness and so on. And so I've seen cases like that. One case I went to when I was in Perth many years ago, we attended actually a funeral of a young woman. She's like 19 years old, and she had basically that was what had happened to her. You know, it was so sad to hear the story of her life, that she was still a student, but she would, all her spare time, she would spend going to animal shelters, to old folks' homes, and just helping people. Yeah, that's all she did. And she had such compassion and such awareness of other people's suffering, but then she just became depressed and committed suicide. Yeah, and that's that extreme of compassion fatigue. That's just a buzzword for it, but I think you know the idea of what I'm talking about, is that there's an over-identification with suffering, which can lead to depression and despair. So that's why it's to start with metta, and then you have that happiness and the joy there. Once you have that, then you can develop the compassion, and you can fully know the suffering without letting it get you depressed and get you down. Yeah.
Bye.
Bhante. Would it then be correct to say that in metta, the type of feeling is what we call in Pali pabhoja, whereas in, you know, when we try to do karuna bhavana, the feeling would be more upeka, equanimity?
No, I don't think so. I think in compassion, you still have a positive feeling, yeah? So there's still a feeling of pleasure, which if you want, you can call pamoja. I think in metta, it's a more, the feeling of pleasure is lighter. It's more simple. So in compassion, you still have there's still a happiness there, but it's a happiness which is tinged with sadness. It's a slight bittersweet kind of flavor to it. It's a slightly different flavor. Yeah, it's not the same lightness to it. It's more like if metta is like champagne, then compassion is more like claret. Yeah. I didn't always used to be a monk, okay? I know what these things taste like.
Okay, Bhante, I mean, if there's a little tinge of sadness to it, would that mean, you know, the latent tendency to aversion would already have tainted the compassion?
Not really, but that's what I'm saying, is that can happen, yeah? If it's not... balanced, and if it's not done with enough maturity and enough wisdom, then yes, that's what can happen, and that will lead to that depression and so on. Yeah, so, but no, if it's done properly, even to say it's a tinge of sadness, I mean, it's just, these are just words that we're kind of using. I mean, it's actually just a kind of a feeling. But there is that recognition of suffering. There is a kind of wisdom that recognizes suffering there. Yeah.
Okay, we have come to the end of this morning session. Let's say sadhu, sadhu, sadhu 3 times to the Bhante. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. And please remain in your seats while